Jesse Felder, founder, editor, and publisher of thefelderreport.com. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Jesse, when we think about the correlation of assets, typically we think of gold and stocks as being uncorrelated, or let's say inversely correlated. Is this an anomalous time right now that stocks and gold have been partying together over the last year to 18 months?
Yeah, I think it is pretty unusual. typically, when you look back over longer periods of time, it's usually either a good time to own one or the other. we can see short stretches where they kind of move together, but generally you go through periods where you really want to own financial assets, i.e. stocks and bonds, or you want to own real assets, and that, precious metals and commodities and those types of things. And usually the macro environment favors one versus the other. And I think, maybe part of the reason why they're trading together right now is I think we're in a transitional time where we're transitioning from a time when it's been really good to own financial assets and own stocks and bonds. Really, the last 15 years has been a great time to do that, less so in the bond market over the last few years. But owning stocks for the last 15 years has been, a can't lose, proposition really for investors. And so it's really paid to favor financial assets. I think right now we're transitioning to a time when it's going to pay to favor real assets. And so they're both doing well together, but gold has dramatically outperformed the stock market this year. And really over, a number of look back periods, if you want to, go back over the last 10 years, 2015, when the gold price really bottomed and turned higher, even since, 2000, if you look at the last 25 years, I think gold's now outperformed the stock market. But I think what the message from gold is right now is that it's going to pay to own real assets going forward. Financial assets are going to struggle relative to real assets.
Mm-hmm. If we get a market correction right now, considering, or let's say, taking the analogy or the time of the dot-com crash and trying to understand, if we get a market correction of that same magnitude, how much wealth does that wipe out for the average American household?
Yeah. Well, the dot-com bust was, a major bear market in the NASDAQ, but also had, was painful, for the S&P 500 as well. Small cap stocks actually did relatively well. So it was one of those bear markets where it wasn't, not all correlations went to one and everything went down together like it did during the great financial crisis in 2008. Everything went down, straight down, and rapidly, and it was a very painful bear market. The dot-com bust was a little bit different in that it was mainly, the NASDAQ went down 90% or something, for the 2-3 years after the 2000 top. I think we could see something similar this time. It kind of takes a financial crisis to drive everything down at the same time like it did in 2008. I think that's unlikely this time. If we do have another bear market, it will be more like the 2000 episode. I think what, is different this time is equities. The total value of equities relative to the size of the economy is so much bigger right now. And essentially, that's the Buffett yardstick, right? Warren Buffett talked about the best way to measure valuations in the stock market is to compare the total value market cap of equities to the total size of the economy. And, his measure is just off the charts today, record highs. And it's, 50% bigger today than it was back then. So the fact that, the Federal Reserve has been focused on wealth effects for 15 years now, it was one of the driving forces, the thinking behind quantitative easing, and is lowering interest rates, boosting asset prices in order to try and boost the economy, creates the risk of a negative wealth effect in the opposite direction. That, because stock prices have become so important, such a big factor relative to the size of the economy, that a decline in the stock market of that magnitude would obviously have important negative wealth effects. And you can just see it today, right? Everybody talks about the K-shaped economy, right? You have people at the bottom of the K are really struggling to keep pace with inflation, and they're spending, they're really being very careful with their spending and cutting back wherever they can to, just to try and make ends meet. The people at the top end of the K, the very, very wealthy, really are not are unaffected by inflation. They're still doing great. They're still spending like crazy, and they're really, holding the economy up right now, is that spending by the people at the top of the K, so to speak. And that's really been driven by the wealth effects of a rising stock market over the last 3 years, really since stocks bottomed in late 2022. It's been kind of a straight up move for 3 years. And that's given a lot of people confidence, a lot of the wealthy confidence in their ability to spend and those types of things. So yeah, those kinds of dynamics would obviously go into reverse and have a meaningful impact on the economy, given the fact that under the surface, the economy is already really weak outside of the spending on the part of the wealthy.
Jesse, you mentioned the wealth effect, or the negative wealth effect of the popping of that bubble, or the decline in the average American household stock market value. Do you think that that puts us in a situation that's far worse than a recession because of that wealth effect, and how that affects people's behavior?
Yeah, I think one of the things that made that recession milder than otherwise would have been was the fact that Alan Greenspan lowered interest rates to 1% and really boosted the real estate market. And real estate is typically much more important to household finances than the stock market, right? The wealth that people have in their house is even more meaningful to most people than the wealth they have invested in the stock market. So Alan Greenspan was able to inflate a housing bubble at the same time the NASDAQ bubble was bursting. And I really think that's going to be very difficult this time with where the state of inflation is. And so I think that, with inflation remaining persistently elevated, it's going to be very difficult for the Fed to be as aggressive in supporting asset prices in a bear market as they have been in the past. So I think that kind of makes this situation unique. Now, I don't think that we're likely to see a recession that's more painful than average. I mean, I honestly, those things, types of things, are probably impossible to forecast. But I do think there is a risk that a lot of people aren't necessarily paying attention to, which is the fact that if we do go into recession again, tax revenues are going to fall. The deficit is already very, very wide, and the bond market's already worried about the deficit and the debt. And so you start getting closer to fiscal debt crisis type of issues. And so that's something that I've been concerned about, especially because I believe there's an earnings bubble, a corporate earnings bubble, right now, that people are talking about this AI bubble, and that's been kind of now become common knowledge, essentially, that there is a bubble in AI stocks that is reminiscent of every bubble going back, the railroad bubble, the internet bubble, where you get these massive build outs, an over investment in an area creates excess capacity, and it eventually busts. But I think not enough people are paying attention to the fact that record corporate profit margins have been enabled by massive deficit spending over the last number of years, last 10 years. And so, people say, point to, P/E ratios and say, well, stocks aren't, as expensive as they were in 2000. Well, profit margins are like twice as high today as they were back then. There was no deficit in 2000. We actually had a fiscal surplus. And so you could argue back then that corporate profits, by the Kalecki equation, corporate profits were actually depressed because we had a fiscal surplus. This fiscal deficit now feeds directly into inflating corporate profits, and it's doing so today in a way that we've really never seen before in the history of the country. So, to the extent that the deficit needs to be reined in, that's a target around corporate profits. And so, if corporate profits were to revert to the mean by way of some type of fiscal discipline, now that's not going to happen Congress is not going to do it on its own. It's going to take some type of market, incident to really, light a fire and demand some type of fiscal discipline. But that could really be, bad news for corporate profits. And it could create a situation where corporate profits peak and don't return to growth for a long period of time. We had a lost decade in the stock market after the dot-com bubble. I think you could have a lost decade in corporate earnings, after this next peak, where corporate earnings peak and then don't return to growth for a long period of time because of the headwinds of, and the deficit really can't widen any more than it already has. Interest rates can't come down. The things that have supported corporate profits for so long, essentially at their limits, and are more likely to reverse and turn the other direction into headwinds. So this corporate earnings bubble, I think, is something that investors aren't probably paying enough attention to.
Well, what are some of the, let's say, the other worrying parts of the AI bubble and how the companies within it are operating, like OpenAI, NVIDIA, Oracle? Is the kiting of capital, share dilution, or this debt-funded shareholder returns, are those some other examples of worrying trends within that, how those companies are operating?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with the AI bubble is the massive shift in the business models of these companies, right? These companies have created essentially monopolies in each one of their spaces, whether it's, search for Google, it's, social media for Meta and the advertising associated with that, Office, Microsoft's Office platform. Amazon had the cloud business to itself for a long period of time. All of these companies, were kind of operating within their own little siloed areas without any competition really at all. Now they're all kind of going at the same thing. They're really competing directly with each other. And this is how it began, was Microsoft saw that ChatGPT might allow them to integrate that into their Bing search engine and really, push Google, create some competition for Google in search. But now all of these companies are kind of getting into this generative AI business model, which puts them all in competition with each other in the cloud. Right now, Microsoft and Google and Amazon, they're all competing in the cloud together. But they're also competing head to head in these, the AI products and services that they're going to try, and AI agents and things. Everybody has their own version of these things, and they're all competing head to head. And they've all gone from very capital light business models to very capital intensive business models. So those two factors of, going from having to spend, very, very little money to generate terrific profits to now you got to spend gobs and gobs of money and really not generating much in the way of profits from the AI is like the 180 in the business model. That combined with the fact that they've gone from very little to no competition to now they're all competing against each other suggests that, it's the future for these business models is a lot less attractive from an investor standpoint than it was in the past. And so valuations on revenues, valuations on earnings, however you want to value these companies, are probably going to come down as people realize, and you can see it in their finances right now. You look at the free cash flow that these companies are generating has plummeted. Meta's free cash flow, Meta, is essentially went from having tens of billions of dollars in cash on the balance sheet to none. They now have net debt on the balance sheet, and the free cash flow is just a fraction of the earnings that they're reporting. So, it's something I've written about in the last few months is follow the money. And all these companies are reporting earnings, and they're using aggressive depreciation schedules and things. And when you look at their free cash flow, how much money are they actually keeping? Cash is coming into the company that's available to shareholders. It's falling in every case, in every single one of these companies. And it's because of the massive spending that's not generating revenues. And so I think that's something that's going to have to be repriced by markets. It's probably part of how this AI bubble bursts is investors start to realize the cash generation is just not there. The profitability of these new models is not there. And in fact, the profitability of their old business lines could be compromised by these new technologies. And the fact that everybody's competing in the same space gives gives them little pricing power to kind of generate the profits that they need to justify the spending they're doing right now.
It's interesting. It's kind of counterintuitive in that way that you would think that competition would be healthy in otherwise in any sector, right?
Yeah. Well, it absolutely is. I think it's great for consumers, right? We're all going to be able to pick from, Anthropic's Claude to ChatGPT to Perplexity to whatever. And, they're not going to be able to, charge a whole lot of money for these things because they're all kind of, commoditized, right? I mean, I've used them all and I'm using Perplexity right now. And I got a year of Perplexity Pro for free to kind of just, try it out. And part of that is, let's, you start with kind of free services, get people hooked, and then you can kind of charge them later on. But I think it's going to be really difficult for these companies to monetize things. You just look at Google search, right? I mean, it would be very difficult for Google to monetize search outside of advertising, because people are just going to say, well, why would I pay for Google when there's plenty of search engines that are just as good, So I think that's the case with a lot of these, chat type of products, is they're just going to be difficult to monetize. And you're already seeing that with companies reining in their projections on the amount of money they're going to be able to generate from subscriptions and to things like the agents and stuff, that are built on these platforms. So, I think, Microsoft is scaling back its expectations. OpenAI recently scaled back its expectations for revenue it expected to generate from agents and things. So, I just think that the competition is absolutely great for consumers, and this is how bubbles go, right? Bubbles usually, the overspending and the overinvestment usually accrues to end users, right? It usually create it built the internet. And all the wonderful things that we take for granted today was all kind of a product of the overspending 25 years ago. All the overspending today is going to create wonderful, products for us to use, but it's not going to likely generate revenues or profits anywhere near, what is being, forecast today for a lot of these companies.
Jesse, do you think it's possible that building and financing these massive data centers ends up being a waste? I listened to a recent podcast with Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, and he brought up the idea that AI will keep getting more and more efficient with power usage and also its ability to run specifically on devices like a phone or laptop rather than needing the build out of these massive data centers.
I absolutely believe that. I think that when you look at, like this is what DeepSeek kind of revealed, back in the beginning of the year, is that for most uses, right, you only need a language model that could literally be run on a Mac. You don't need a language model that has to be run in a 1 gigawatt data center. Right. And so what we're essentially doing right now is we're saying, I need to walk across the street and go to the grocery store. So I'm going to fire up an 18-wheeler, tractor trailer, pull it, go park it across, just to drive across the street. And I'm going to use all that energy. And, it's just a huge waste. And I think that's what this is what AI insiders are saying, is that, for all intents and purposes, for these models, what we need to be spending, and this is what China is doing, is we need to be spending our time and energy and creating very, very much, much smaller, more targeted models for whatever it is that we're trying to accomplish. That could be far less energy intensive, far less compute intensive, and really much more tailored to whatever it is you're trying to accomplish, rather than using this humongous large language model that's been programmed with all the known data on Earth, in the history of the universe, to just answer a question about, is it safe to feed my dog X? You know what I mean? Like, you could create a little model, you just look at, hey, you have questions about your pet? Here's the thing. And it can run on the tiniest little computer. You don't need the data center. So I think that's, yes, I think that's what we're going to find is there's massive waste in this spending on data centers. Really what these companies, have said to justify it is that they're going to create, artificial general intelligence, essentially computers that are as adept as human beings at solving problems and can do self-learning and these types of things. But what some of the, many of the top researchers in AI are saying today is that just making these language models bigger will never get us to that goal of artificial general intelligence. Not generative AI, AGI is something different. It's the real, when you think of what artificial intelligence has been promised to us, it's, HAL, in Space Odyssey, 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's, the kind of fictional AI that we think of. These, just scaling these large language models by throwing more compute at them and more data at them is very unlikely. It's really just not going to get us there. And that's really what these companies are really doing. And so they're throwing this all this money and effort and energy at a problem that is not going to be solved in the way they're trying to solve it. So yes, I do think there's going to be it's massive overspending once again. Now, all that, just like the railroad bubble, just like the dot-com bubble, all this infrastructure could be used very cheaply after the bubble bursts and create opportunities for say, oh, look, this compute prices have fallen 99%. I can now go create some of these cool models and experiments that I wanted to do that were too expensive to do a few years ago. So it will benefit us as users, but it will really, I think be problematic for companies that are on the front end of it right now, like Oracle, like the hyperscalers that are the ones overspending right now.
So in that case, Jesse, how do these companies keep funding themselves with debt if liquidity or appetite wanes here?
I don't think they can. I mean, there's so many constraints that they're already running into. Right. I mean, you look at like the forecasts for OpenAI's, revenue growth and the forecast for NVIDIA's revenue growth. And, there's actually no way for them to attain them in the short run. They're already running into real problems. One of them is capital. OpenAI, needs whatever it is. They want to spend $1.4 trillion over the next few years on data centers and chips and these types of things. It's already difficult for SoftBank to kind of come up with, 10, 20 billion to kind of, fund them over the next year. The fact, to kind of say that, okay, we're having a hard time coming up with 20 billion, but we're going to come up with 1.4 trillion is, it's the height of, ridiculousness. The other side of it is, it's not just capital constraints that they're running into. I think they're also running into energy constraints right now too, where the grid, the electrical grid, is just not. China is their grid is growing so they're expanding their grid so much faster, like 10 times faster than we are, and we just can't keep up. We just don't have the infrastructure. You look at the lead time on just getting, natural gas plants built, let alone kind of nuclear and these types of things to kind of generate the energy needed to run these things. And there's no way that they're going to grow the amount of data centers in the next 2, 3 years that they intend to. The capital's not there, the energy's not there. So I think growth is going to start to disappoint. And at the same time, you'll probably start realizing that, we don't need 1.4 trillion in data centers, and that, the whole idea is a farce anyways.
So, I think that's a perfect segue, Jesse. Is the energy sector, do you think, a good counterbalance right now to own versus the Mag 7?
Yeah. I think, you got to think about what The gold price has been so strong, right, this year and really over the last few years. What is the gold price telling us? Well, gold is typically a leading indicator for the rest of the commodity space. And so we're starting to see this now, right? We've seen gold scream higher. We've seen copper prices start to take off lately. We've seen natural gas prices hit multi-year highs recently. And these aren't really reflective of the demand side of things. Demand's pretty good. I mean, it hasn't fallen off in the way that would make you think, oh gosh, we're headed for recession. At least not yet. But it's really the supply side of things. And this comes back to the capital cycle. And I've got, it's probably up here somewhere. It's a great book on the capital cycle and how it drives returns in markets. And so
What,
we're
sorry,
gonna,
Jesse, what's the name of that book?
let me see, where is it? Capital returns.
Okay.
Maybe it's out of the picture. I don't know. Capital returns. It's really the only book that I've read that is specifically talks about this capital cycle and how crucial it is to asset price returns going forward. And essentially, it's a very simple framework. It's when a bunch of capital is going into a sector of the economy, it ends up creating a bunch of supply in that area, which means prices crater. And a good example of this was back in, the mid 2000s, right? When I was talking about Alan Greenspan lowering interest rates to 1%, and then Bernanke eventually lowered them to zero for a long period of time, created very cheap capital. A lot of that capital went into a new invention, fracking, right?
Right.
Companies realized, okay, well, we instead of traditional wells, we're kind of running out of oil production in the United States via traditional wells, created this new process, fracking. Investors got super excited. So much capital went into the energy sector, and eventually oil prices, was overdrilled, right? Massively overdrilled. Too much capital created, too much supply of oil. Oil price crashed. That was basically the same thing. Look back to the previous bubble before that. It was the same thing with the dot-com and housing bubble. Too much capital goes into a space because investors are super excited about whatever it is, creates an oversupply of that, and this that oversupply overwhelms demand, prices crater. We saw that in the dot-com. We saw that in the housing bubble. That's what we're seeing in AI today, is so much capital is going into AI. It's going to create a massive oversupply, and that's going to lead to terrible returns for a period of time. That's just the nature of the capital cycle. So where you want to look as an investor is what areas have been starved of capital? Because those are the areas where they're going to be undersupplied. And you wonder why are natural gas prices going up? Why are copper prices going up? These areas of real assets have been undersupplied for capital for the better part of 10 years or longer. And so supply in new streams of copper coming online are just not there. Yes, we've had fracking for a long period of time, but in the case of natural gas, the largest areas of growth for oil and natural gas in terms of fracking are really starting to see peak production and roll over, and they're starting to run out of the easiest areas to frack. At the same time, we're now, shipping liquid natural gas all over the world. So demand is growing dramatically for natural gas. At the same time, supply has been stagnating because capital, with ESG mandates and all of these things, energy companies have been starved of capital for 10 plus years. So I really do think, yes, this is part of the case for real assets is, all this investment in the supplies of these things that we need has not kept pace with growth in the economy and these types of things. And so these areas of the market that have been starved of capital are really, and energy is probably, one of the most important ones right now, are really poised to do well going forward just because of the constrained supplies meeting, persistently growing demand is a very bullish fundamental setup.
Should we think about kind of breaking apart the energy sector a little bit more, Jesse? Let's say oil and gas producers or transporters like midstream companies versus infrastructure like transformer fabricators or maybe even nuclear plant or SMR producers.
Yes. I'm when I'm talking about energy, I'm m mostly talking about oil and gas exploration and production companies. The infrastructure companies were really interesting a few years ago. They got to the point where I think oil price went negative, and everybody kind of thought, oh, we're going to stop producing oil and gas, and we're going to not need to ship it around the world and whatever. And so the pipeline companies got really interesting several years ago. I think that trade is pretty much played out, where those companies have done really, really well, the infrastructure side of things. I think now it's much more interesting from the side of the producers of oil and gas. These stocks are really, really cheap, and it's probably the only sector in the stock market that is not correlated with the rest, with the AI trade and the rest of the market, right? Most of these, I mean, maybe consumer staples and healthcare are kind of, defensive in nature, and don't decline probably as much as others in a recession. But energy is really trades kind of independent of the rest of the market. And we saw that in 2022 when the NASDAQ stocks kind of got, pretty hammered, especially in all the meme stocks and things. We had a pretty decent little bear market in 2022. At the same time, energy stocks did phenomenally well. And so, yeah, I do think that is kind of a tell that if you are worried about, another type of 2022 type of, bear market, energy might be a decent place to kind of consider, as a non-correlated area to the rest of the market.
Do you think that global inflationary pressures are not fully priced in by treasury yields yet as well?
It's a good question. I think treasuries right now are long-term treasuries are really, trying to battle, between, and it's tough because, right, with the government shutdown, we haven't had, all the data that we normally would have. But I do think we are in a mild stagflationary period right now. We have persistently elevated inflation, and we have relatively weak economic growth. We have rising unemployment. I mean, if you think about what is the definition of stagflation, think about the 70s and think about rising unemployment and rising prices, right? It's a miserable time for consumers. And people wonder why are consumers so unhappy, right? You look at the University of Michigan survey, and people say current conditions are the worst they've ever been. Right, current economic conditions, the worst they've ever been in a survey that goes back to the 60s. So they're saying things are worse today than they are in the 1970s. That might be due to other factors, but I do think it does come back to the fact that the labor market is very weak, right? It's if you don't have a job, it's really tough to get one in this labor market right now. At the same time, price pressures are still there. Right, we've had this huge surge in inflation a few years ago, and prices. I think people, consumers, probably thought, okay, when they're going to get inflation under control, that means prices are going to come back down to some degree. And economists have a different idea. They say, no, that we're going to just slow the growth, hopefully to 2% a year, but it's still going up. That, I think that's where there's a disconnect between economists and consumers. And consumers are like, wait, no. I want prices back to where they were in 2019, 2018, right? It's much, much harder for me to make ends meet with prices where they are today. And if they're still rising at 3% plus, it's that much harder. So I do think we're in a stagflationary period right now, and it's really difficult for the bond market to try and figure out, okay, typically rising unemployment, slowing economic growth, interest rates usually fall, long-term interest rates, right? Because price in lower growth and those types of things. But when you have rising inflation, persistently elevated inflation, treasury investors are going to go, hey, I'm not going to, I'm accept 3% for third on a 30-year treasury if inflation could potentially be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 again, right? We could potentially get another surge in inflation. So, I think that's what treasuries are battling with right now, is it looks like we could be maybe on the verge of recession, which would call for probably lower long-term bond yields, but inflation is potentially going the other way. That's the message from gold. That's the message from copper prices. The message from natural gas prices is commodities are telling you inflation's not going away. So I think that yeah, the bond market is really kind of stuck between those two things.
So does this also put the Fed in a really difficult position here, Jesse? It seems like investors are really accustomed to the idea that the Fed will always come to the rescue in a scenario like a crash. But what do you also see as the Fed's ability to be effective in a market crash at this time, considering, the tools that they have available to them, and B, the inflation and the elevated markets that we're already seeing.
It's interesting. The last couple times we've had, real volatility in the stock market, we've also seen volatility in the bond market. And I think that, like you look at the COVID crash, and we had some real treasury volatility back then. I'm worried that in the next time that it becomes obvious that the economy's in recession, typically that would send long-term bond yields down. Investors, as I was saying, bet on slower growth, lower interest rates, all those kinds of things. This is something I've talked about for the last couple of years. I think in the next recession, the bond market could go the other way, and bond investors say, okay, we're going into recession again. Yeah, we're going to have lower growth, whatever, but that's a problem for when the debt is so massive, because we're going to have to, the deficit is going to go blow out even further. And so issuance of treasuries is going to have to explode even more. So supply, we're going to have this massive supply of treasuries coming on, and there's not going to be that much demand for it, because if the Fed is forced to monetize it, inflation could really take off again. And I think this is something that, the Fed is really playing with fire here, is the idea that, okay, inflation's been above target for 4 or 5 years now, right? And we're not necessarily committed to bringing it back to target, because if you get another surge in inflation, you probably are looking at de-anchoring inflation expectations, and all these types of things, losing the bond market. And so I think if I were, on the Fed, I would say, look, the economy is still doing okay. We really need to bring inflation back to target. And there are those voices on the Fed that are saying this, and I think they're justified. So I think that, yeah, the Fed is in a really difficult position, but I think they also know that if inflation starts to really pick up again, they're going to be in a much, much more difficult position, because their hands will be tied. You can't go print trillions of dollars in new money, if inflation is going the wrong way. And that's what might be required to prevent a really steep decline in the stock market. If the AI bubble bursts, and it's clear that corporate earnings are going to turn south again. Especially with all the leverage in the stock market right now, if you start getting a deleveraging, in terms of, just less spending and 0-day options, less money into leveraged ETFs, margin debt is off the chart. If you get a deleveraging in the stock market, you're going to need the Fed to come to the rescue to prevent another major bear market. And like I said, their hands may be tied by inflation. So I think the Fed has made a major mistake in not being more committed to bringing inflation down and holding rates at restrictive levels for a longer period of time.
How do you think that plays into the next Fed chair and what Trump's ambitions are for the Fed? He's known as this guy that wants lower rates, that wants a very dovish Fed, wants, the ability to have as much debt as he wants. So if he gets his way, how does that square with what needs to happen to keep the economy, quote unquote, healthy, or at least kind of plodding along the way it has been?
It makes me think of, there's the famous quote, "Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it." I think Santayana, and then Kurt Vonnegut said that I have news from Mr. Santayana, to repeat the mistakes of history is to just be human. And so I think that, that's the lesson with these bubbles, with the AI bubble, is that we're going to continue to have bubbles because just the nature of them is, the nature of the greed associated with, oh my gosh, I can make so much money. Look at these stock prices are going nuts. We're going to pour more money into this. And so it's just the way human nature works. But it's the same thing too with inflation and where we are in terms of the monetary cycle. You look back to the last major episode of inflation in the 70s, and the central bank never really did enough until Paul Volcker to really break the back of inflation, and they really didn't have the spine that it took to kind of say, okay, we need to ramp up interest rates and hold them until inflation comes back under control. And that was, a lot of that was driven by pressure from, Richard Nixon on the Fed, and to keep interest rates low to, run the economy hot. And I think there's a lot of similarities today with Trump wants to run the economy hot for the midterm elections. He wants monetary policy to kind of be complicit with that. And to the extent that the central bank is complicit with that, we risk literally a replay of the 1970s, right? A replay of, okay, we're going to, favor the employment side of the mandate over the inflation side, even when it's clear that inflation is a problem. Yeah, you risk another steep rise in inflation. And I think that's probably with, the next Fed chair, Trump's pretty clear on who he wants that to be. And all the candidates that he've looked at is essentially who's going to be the most compliant with White House policy. So I think it's pretty clear that at least the Fed chair is going to be arguing for easier monetary policy and allow the inflation side of the mandate to be the side that is kind of let go. And so I think that, yeah, inflation is likely headed higher. It's also another, feather in the cap for the real assets play. I think this is what, part of what gold is telling us is that, yeah, there's just not the resolve at the central bank to do what it takes to bring in inflation. And so gold is saying inflation's going to go higher, and all these commodity prices are going to start to follow gold's lead and really kind of drive that message home for investors that inflation is not defeated by any stretch.
Mm-hmm. So Jesse, I wanted to ask you about how you think about playing these things, like what your actual action plan is on this stuff. You have model ETF portfolios on your website. Do you choose ETFs because you don't like the risk of picking individual stocks?
Well, I have in my premium product, I use the model, the ETF portfolio, to just kind of demonstrate how diversification, I think, can really be utilized by investors, in a way to really protect them from, any one real risk. In my pro product, I do discuss individual stocks. And so I do write about, individual energy stocks, some consumer staple stocks look interesting right now. What really drives the individual stock activity is not so much a macro framework, though, is it's more of a bottoms up type of approach. So I look very closely at insider activity. What are the top executives at these companies doing with their own money? Right. For example, you can see it in, all the top people at CoreWeave have been unloading stock. It tells you how much confidence they have in being the number one company building out data centers. It doesn't seem like they have a ton of confidence in the longevity of that business model. But the flip side of that, you can find companies where you have executives buying. In a lot of cases, over the last couple of years, there's been these kind of billionaire energy investors. I've been kind of saying slowly taking their companies private. Actually, Harold Hamm eventually did take Continental Resources private again, but he was buying tens of millions of dollars worth of stock back in late 2021, which was a very, very bullish sign that he thought the shares were dramatically undervalued, and eventually they did go up a ton. Jerry Jones is another one who's been buying shares in his natural gas company. So yeah, in the energy space, there's some interesting investor insider buying activity, and that's one of kind of the ways I look to generate ideas in the space. But it also can help with the kind of an overall idea, because when you look at the total sell to buy ratio, that's actually one of the best indicators for future earnings growth, future economic growth. And the insider selling that we've seen over the last 2 years has been massive. I'm talking in aggregate. You take all of the top executives, and the selling relative to buying has been huge. And that's usually a really good sign that the economy is headed for recession, corporate earnings are peaking and rolling over. And we're right now in the heart of that forecast. So that if all that selling, in 24 and 25 over these last 2 years is was prescient, then those kind of bearish economic factors are going to start to materialize right about now.
Right.
So I think we're in that interesting time right now from an insider standpoint.
I remember certain cases or certain times where people were looking at insider selling, especially, in the Mag 7 type companies, and that being pointed to as a possible recessionary time, or, where the rubber hits the road. Is it, let's say it can it be misleading at times? Or is it a perfect indicator?
No. I think it is misleading most of the time. I think if you just, go look at one individual stock and you see insider selling by, an executive or two, it usually doesn't mean anything. I mean, most of the time, these guys are just diversifying. They have, 100% of their net worth, in a lot of cases, are invested in the shares of this one company. I think, a lot of the executives at OpenAI, it's a good example of that. They did a sale where they allowed a lot of the employees to sell shares in OpenAI. You just understand that from the standpoint of, okay, that's probably 100% of their net worth is invested in shares of a private company they can't liquidate otherwise. I think the way to look at it is look at it historically. I look at individuals, and I want to see their individual track record, right? Because there are people who, sometimes you have insider buying and it's meaningless. It's just, they call it painting the tape. They're just trying to make it look like, and I
Right.
think this is that was the case with Elon's recent buy of Tesla shares, right? He really wanted to make the case that he was, all in on making, taking Tesla to the next level, and really wanted investors to vote on his compensation package. So he went and bought
Right.
$1 billion with Tesla to say, here we go. But he had sold, what, $10 billion in Tesla a couple of years ago. So it's really not, comparable. And he doesn't really have a terrific track record in terms of, trading the shares. But there are people who you look at them, and every time so-and-so, buys a significant amount of stock, it returns a couple years later are usually really good. Those are the types of scenarios that I look for. And as I said, when you aggregate it and you put it all together, it does take a lot of the noise and turn it into an important signal. Najat Sehun wrote a book. He's a business professor at University of Michigan, who's really kind of quantified this and showed that it's literally one of the best leading indicators of economic activity and stock prices over, 1 to 2 year time frame is aggregate. Put it all the insider selling relative to insider buying, and it tells you kind of really where corporate America is headed at the moment. Are executives bullish or bearish in aggregate? That's an important signal.
Yeah, it's an interesting signal that you have to look at in the context of, the broader economy, and let's say what the broader set of companies and executives are thinking and feeling, right?
For sure. Yeah. And like, 'cause a lot of times they're, saying one thing and doing another. And so I always like to say, and you can also to look at my friend Asif Surya. He's got a terrific website. It's insidearbitrage.com, where he tracks a lot of this stuff. When a company is buying back stock and insiders are buying both at the same time. He kind of calls those double dippers. Those are really interesting situations. A lot of times, what you'll see way more often is a company buying back stock, insiders selling. And so the stock buyback can kind of help support the shares while insiders are offloading into it. That's not really what you want to see as a as an investor. I'd much prefer, as an investor in the company, to see a company be more opportunistic. Stock price sells off if they think it's too cheap. Okay, I want to see insiders buying, and I want to see company buy back stock. That's a good sign that the company clearly thinks shares are undervalued at those levels.
And has some room on their balance sheet to support that as well, right?
For sure. Yeah.
Excellent, Jesse. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners to consider before we wrap up here today? That was a, I think that's a really good signal and discussion around this kind of insider selling it and buying.
Yeah, no, I would just think say that, from a longer term perspective, I think it's really important to consider, okay, how much exposure do I have to financial assets versus real assets? Because in an environment, we talked a lot about stagflation in the 70s. Financial assets did terribly in that environment. Whether it was stocks or bonds, you did poorly owning financial assets. What did really phenomenally well during that time was real assets. And so, to the extent we're kind of replaying that, history's rhyming with that earlier period, even if it isn't repeating, I want to make sure that I have exposure to real assets to protect me from, an environment where, if I'm only in a 60-40 portfolio, stocks, bonds, I don't have the diversification to protect me in that type of an environment.
Right. Of course, for anybody that wants to read your weekly blog where you put together a couple interesting charts and tidbits from the week, that's all available at thefelderreport.com. And of course, all of your other stuff is available there too. Jesse, thanks so much for your time today. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks.